Major funding for On Point is provided by Liberty Mutual for all your auto, home, life, and business insurance needs. Liberty Mutual. Responsibility. What's your policy?
From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. We're not taking cash to the grocery store in wheelbarrows yet. But everybody knows prices are up all over. Inflation is here. Oil has driven it, but that's not all. With oil and commodities down, inflation may retreat, but not yet, not in the latest figures, and wages aren't keeping up. This hour On Point, we're dealing with inflation. Joining me first today from Washington is Greg Ipp, U.S. Economics Editor for The Economist magazine. Greg, welcome back.
Hello, Tom.
We've got big numbers out today. Tell us about them.
Well, we had another bad inflation number today, Tom. Labor Department told us that producer prices, which is basically the price that manufacturers and wholesalers get for their goods when they deliver them to the retailers, were up sharply in July, and the year-on-year increase is running at around 10%, which is the highest in 27 years. Now, that is almost entirely due to soaring prices for energy and food, and if you strip out those components, then wholesale and price inflation is only running at around 3.5%, but that's still pretty high. And although this excludes some important categories like services, if you go back a week, Tom, the consumer price index, which is a much broader measure of the inflation that ordinary Americans face, also was very troubling. It showed overall inflation at around 5.6%, which is the highest we've seen since 1990-91. And again, taking out the energy and food numbers makes it look a lot better. We had that so-called core inflation rate only at around 2.5%. But even that number has been accelerating.
Greg, there's something I've never understood. Why take out food and energy? For most families, these are the number one items in their budget, the things you cannot live without.
The reason why, Tom, is that the two are also extremely volatile. It's not unusual to have energy prices in particular go up 1 or 2% one month and down 1 or 2% the following month. And when you have that, it's very difficult to discern the total trend. And so economists and central bankers became accustomed to looking at the core rate to better understand the underlying trend. Now, the wrinkle there, of course, is that for the last 3 or 4 years, they have been going straight up with very little pullback, and as a result, it's been deceptive to kind of think that if you looked at the core inflation rate, you would get an idea of the underlying trend. That said, Tom, there are reasons to believe that inflation will fall back more towards that more subdued inflation number that we look at if we just look at the core number. And that's because, as most Americans know, gasoline prices have actually finally started to pull back thanks to the big drop in crude oil.
And oil down further, closer to 100 than to 150, a blessing right there. On the other hand, Greg, last week when the big consumer price index numbers came out, everybody was saying, well, commodity prices are softening, maybe inflation is starting to soften too. And then here comes this producer price index, inflation running at about twice what was expected, as I read the reports here.
Well, that's true, Tom, but both these numbers are for the month of July when we were roughly facing the highest level in gasoline prices ever, and things have pulled back substantially since then. But there is a more fundamental reason, Tom, to feel that this inflation trend is not going to be here to stay, and that's because our knowledge of economic history suggests that you can only get a sustained high and accelerating inflation rate when not just prices but also wages are rising, because that's what happens when workers begin to say, well, I need to be compensated in my purchasing power for these ever-rising costs. And employers agree, and that higher labor cost then has to be passed on to prices again, and you get what we call a wage-price spiral.
What is going on with wages as inflation surges?
Not much, unfortunately, for the average working person. There's been no acceleration in wages when you include compensation, such as benefits, at all in the last year or two. In fact, it's been quite soft. And what's more, with the unemployment rate heading steadily higher in recent months, the odds are it's going to be even harder for the average worker to get any increase in their salary. And so it's going to be very difficult to get a wage-price spiral going without the wage piece sort of playing its part.
Now, I've got a question about that, but let me ask you first. I'm reading here that rank-and-file workers, production, non-supervisory roles, earned 3.1% less than they did a year ago after adjusting for the rising cost of living. So I guess you take the consumer price index and put it against the soft wages, and that's how, so maybe they got a couple percent, and they're running 3% below where they were a year ago. Is that what it means?
Yeah, that's exactly what it means, Tom. I mean, the reason there's no wage price spiral is precisely because of what you just explained. The average worker is having to eat these costs and is not getting any improvement in their paycheck. And let's look at a broader level at why this is going on, Tom, because the rising costs, especially on oil, are not going to American producers. They're going to foreign producers. America imports over half of its petroleum. So when these prices go up, the benefits don't flow to the bottom line of American companies and their employees.
So they can't pay higher wages. But here's my question on that front. Maybe this is something different. Okay, wages are not going up for Americans. In fact, they're going down. What I see here is a reduction in the standard of living. But wages are going up in Asia, where there's also plenty of inflation. Could it be different this time? Could higher wages elsewhere in the world, where they used to be poor, now support, you know, inflation here, even when our wages aren't going up?
Yeah, there's definitely what you could call a rebalancing of economic growth going on, where the developing nations, especially India and China, have been running their economies at breakneck pace. That's been very good for the citizens of those countries who started at an extremely poor and an often subsistence standard of living. In China, for example, they've been enjoying 10% real gains in their wages, that is to say after inflation, for many years now. And that's good for all the Chinese there. But one of the drawbacks is that those countries have a lot less experience in terms of anchoring inflation, and that they do have a problem where their central banks, especially, for example, in India, have been very reluctant to raise interest rates enough to stop the inflation in fuel and food prices from becoming embedded in wages. And they could have a serious inflation problem. I think it's less likely, quite a bit less likely, that that sort of problem is going to take hold in the United States.
Well, let's hope so, but the world is changing. Greg Ipp, now at The Economist, U.S. Economics Editor there. Always great talking with you, Greg. Thanks very much for being here today.
Pleasure to help, Tom.
We'll hear in a moment from economists Ethan Harris of Lehman Brothers and Zvi Bodie of Boston University. But joining me first from Seattle is Patricia Edwards, retail analyst at the investment counseling firm Wentworth, Hauser & Weilich. She's a close watcher of consumer goods prices. Patricia, welcome to On Point.
Pleasure to be here, Tom.
You really follow the retail world right across the board. Tell us what you see out there in terms of inflation, price hikes.
You know, the price hikes just keep on coming. It's really interesting. If you look back to February, we saw 6-7% price increases for paper and plastic goods, for example. I was just talking with Costco a few weeks ago. They said there is another 6-7% coming across the board in those categories in September. Household chemicals are going up something like 16%. Year over year, we're looking at tuna. Of all things, tuna up 30%.
So you're talking paper towels up, diapers up, paper plates up, I don't know, plastic forks and spoons and tuna, kind of basic for the lunchbox.
Very, very basic things. Basmati rice, 20 pounds used to be $10.99. It's $24.99 at Costco today. You know, just the basics in life have gone up significantly for the average consumer.
Do you see oil driving this or other factors driving it? If oil comes down, do you see these prices coming down?
Well, oil is partly to blame, especially in the plastics and things like that. And frankly, it's because of every good that the consumer consumes and buys at the store has to be transported from someplace. In some cases, it's from overseas. In some cases, it's domestically. Regardless, those transportation costs, of course, are way, way up. You know, gas prices are up 36% year over year, and while they have fallen off their highs, they're still only down about 7%. So gas is part of it. But then you think about the amount of corn that has gone into ethanol. That corn then feeds into higher meat prices. The higher meat prices, people can't afford meat, so they trade down to beans, higher bean prices. And it becomes a bit of a domino effect and a bit of a spiral, frankly.
How is this changing the way consumers shop and what they buy, Patricia?
It is changing it significantly, actually. If you look at all the retailers, or most of the retailers anyway, put out what they call comp store sales. It's usually the first Thursday of every month. And we get a look at who's doing well and who is doing better on the same store base year over year. And amazingly, the numbers are bad across the board, with the exception of the folks who are selling food. So Walmart's doing well. Costco's doing well. BJ's Wholesale doing well, putting up phenomenal gains. Everyone else is frankly struggling.
How does anybody put up gains when prices are going up but wages aren't rising? How does that work?
Well, what's happening is we're seeing the consumer trade down. So if you used to go into your local Kroger or Safeway store or A&P, maybe you're not doing that anymore. Maybe you're buying in bulk. Maybe you're one of those folks who takes your truck once a month and goes and buys, you know, a lifetime supply of toilet paper at the warehouse club, picks up all of your meat. You know, I know personally that I've been doing more of that myself, because you can go in and you can get a much better deal if you can buy in bulk and store it. The problem is then you're paying for the energy to keep it up.
Now, this is a global picture these days. What happens in China or India matters here. Even the Olympics matter for American prices, you've said, Patricia.
Absolutely. You know, one of the things that they've done over in Beijing to clean up the air is to shut down some of the factories around Beijing. And I've heard from a couple of different management teams that there is some concern on their part that some of those factories are not going to be reopened. You know, people have planned, the retailers have planned ahead of time going into the Christmas season that they knew that these places weren't going to be closed, and they've ordered ahead.
So what were they making that might be more expensive now or soon?
Well, the big one is patio furniture, that plastic patio furniture that you get that's made out of oil. That's highly polluting. And the thought is that that come spring could be very, very expensive. And in fact, there are some retailers who are saying their connections are saying some of those places aren't going to reopen until they get their air purification set up. And that could be months or even a year. Shoes, another thing that are made significantly, like 78% of all shoes in the U.S. are made in China.
Patricia, and we've just got 20 seconds here. What do you see coming? More price hikes or less? When you talk to retailers, when you advise consumers, is this going to get better or same, worse?
There's more coming, at least in the short run.
Wow. Okay. Up all over and up in a way that can hurt right in your shoes. Patricia Edwards joining us there from Seattle from Wentworth, Hauser & Vialich. Thank you very much for being with us, Patricia.
My pleasure.
I'm joined now in the studio by Zvi Bodhi. He's professor of finance and economics at Boston University. His latest book is Worry-Free Investing. We'd all like to have some of that. Zvi Bodhi, welcome back. Great to have you. Thanks for being
here. Great to be here, Tom.
And with us from New York, Ethan Harris, managing director and chief U.S. economist at Lehman Brothers in New York, author of Ben Bernanke's Fed, the Federal Reserve After Greenspan. He worked for 9 years at the Federal Reserve Bank of New York. Ethan Harris, very good to have you. Thanks for being here today.
Thank you, Tom.
So how do you see it? We've clearly had a spate of inflation. It's clearly hurting. It's hitting people, you know, in the pocketbook like crazy. There's been anticipation that lower oil prices would mean it'll cool off and we'll be fine. What do you think, Ethan? Is that where we're headed?
Yeah, I think it's darkest before the dawn here. Clearly, you've got a very serious inflation problem right now. But if you go back in history, there's one thing that kills inflation, and that is a recession. And the U.S. economy is in the equivalent of a recession right now. A weak economy makes it hard for companies to pass on prices. It hurts commodity prices. We're beginning to see weak growth globally, lowering oil and food and other commodity prices. So we know from history that you know inflation can get very high until we see a sustained period of weak growth, and that tends to kill the inflation. And we believe in the next year we will see lower inflation.
Has your faith in that been shaken at all by the producer price index out today, about double what people expected, 9.8%? That's a big hike.
Well, as Greg said, you know, that data predates the decline in energy and food prices. The data are collected in the beginning of the month of July, and energy prices were peaking as those data were collected. Inflation will come down gradually as we see some of this easing back of energy prices. It's not going to be right away. It's still going to feel very painful for a little while out there for people. But, you know, as we go into the new year, I think we will be in a better situation.
Zvi Bodhi, just hang on for a couple of months and we'll be fine. That would be great. Do you see it that way?
No, I don't, Tom. I guess you could call me a bit of a pessimist with regard to inflation. I have a long memory. When I wrote my doctoral dissertation in 1975 at MIT,
yeah,
the topic was hedging against inflation.
Mm-hmm.
And in lots of ways, this current decade is looking to me like the 1970s.
Well, that was the belly of the beast. It was terrible. That was inflation. That was stagflation. But there was a wage price spiral then. There were unions that pushed hard for higher wages. They went up. There was an economy as weak as it was with the capacity to produce those, you know, to grant those higher wages. A lot of people saying now that's not.
You're absolutely right, Tom. History repeats itself, but never in exactly the same way. So that's why reasonable people can disagree.
How would we keep inflation going if wages aren't going up? What's the gas in the tank?
Well, first of all, I do believe wages will go up. They have to go up. I mean, let's look at a professor like me. Mm. There's only so long that I'm going to be content to see my real wages fall. as a result of inflation.
Who promised you or anybody else contentment in this age? Maybe we're going to be discontented. Maybe we're going to have a lower standard of living.
You're quite right. The way it occurs is workers, even tenured professors, if they are in demand, start looking elsewhere for employment. And so as long as there's competition out there, you're going to see wages moving up to match price increases.
Ethan Harris, the mob's going to be at the gate. Mobs of tenured professors banging at the palace door. Yeah, I mean, but you know what Zvi's saying. A lot of people are feeling it. I just can't live on what I'm being paid with this inflation. I've got to have more. Could that pressure produce the wage part of a wage price spiral?
Well, I would agree if we had a healthy economy, but the economy isn't healthy, and the unemployment rate's already risen more than a percentage point in the last year and is likely to continue to rise.
Yep.
You know, workers right now have very little negotiating power. Obviously, unions have been weakened over time, but even for the average worker, with this kind of job market right now, you just can't go to your employer and ask for a cost of living increase. Now, it's important here that this inflation doesn't go on indefinitely, because then we will get the pass-through into wages, and it's important that we see some easing back of commodity pressures and some easing back in the core measure of inflation that Greg Ipp talked about, so we don't get that wage-price spiral. But I don't think we're on the verge of a wage-price spiral right now. Workers just don't have the negotiating power.
Zvi, how about it? Unemployment is up. We've got a weak economy, so where would the wage part of this come from?
No, you're quite right. And Tom, I think there's a really important point to make here, which I, as a professor of finance, feel obliged to make, which is we could argue from now until doomsday, or at least until the end of the show, about what the rate of inflation is going to be. The fact is nobody, including professional forecasters, know what it's going to be. There's a great range of uncertainty about inflation. And that's what makes people feel insecure. If we all knew for sure that inflation was going to be 2% or 3%, we'd all adjust, and interest rates would adjust, wages would adjust. And trust me, even without a wage price spiral, you'd see wages adjusting. The issue is inflation uncertainty.
But still, what drives it? If wages aren't there, you can only have inflation if people pay more for goods. If they can't, at some point, afford to pay any more, doesn't that put the brakes on?
Well, if you believe that there's any degree of competition in the labor market, it is driven by real wages, real labor compensation, not nominal, but real. So if there is inflation driving down real wages, you're going to see a supply-demand imbalance. It'll start in those professions where you kind of have bottlenecks. So very high wages will be produced there, and then it'll shift. You know, there'll be a knock-on effect to other parts of the labor market. It's simple supply and demand.
Ethan, I want to get to you on that, but we have a lot of listeners who want to join us. Let's go to Toronto and David. David, you're on the air.
Yes, hi. I travel a great deal for my job, and I've noticed prices increasing all over the world due to inflation, which is the topic of your show.
Yep.
And I am very concerned as a member of what's left of the middle class that if inflation continues at this pace, we might, the middle class, that is, be wiped out, and the entire tax base would go that governments depend on for infrastructure and other basic services. So,
and when you hear economists saying oil is coming down, wages aren't going up, so inflation is going to moderate, do you take comfort in that? Do you share that confidence?
I don't really. I'm just concerned that my savings are frittering away because of the financial meltdown, which is coupled with the inflation.
Yeah, I hear that from just about everybody. David in Toronto, thanks for that. Let's go to Jane in Oak Island, North Carolina. Jane, you're on the air.
Yes, I'm a real estate broker. I've been in the business a long time. I went 7 months last in the last 12 months without selling anything.
Ouch.
I'm living off my, you know, my savings, and I'm not a big real estate, you know, company. I'm a small one, but you know, I love selling real estate, and I just don't know where this is going to end. We have customers looking five, six. We're in the second home market because we're a beach community.
Mm-hmm.
So we have people looking five, six, seven times. They have the money to buy because they have the cash, but they're not buying because of the market.
So how does inflation figure into this picture, Jane? Where does inflation fit into that tough scene?
Well, the cost of fuel and the cost of everything else, and people are so scared to spend money that they've been saving, say, for a beach home, a beach cottage,
mm-hmm.
but they're just not spending the money. They're holding on to it and looking, and they just keep looking for those homes. But even though they keep thinking that it's going to bottom out at some point in the next 12 months,
mm-hmm.
the real estate market, so they can buy a beach home for, you know, if they're looking at $300,000, they'll be able to buy that beach home for $200,000.
So there's a kind of emotional effect or fear factor that comes in even to the real estate market. And Jane, we hope you make a sale right there real soon to help pay for those groceries. Stuart in Beverly, Massachusetts, you're on the air.
Hey, Tom. Thanks
Hi.
For taking my call.
Yeah.
Great show. There's obviously a lot I want to say, but I, the only thing I really want to get to this point is the reality of inflation has hit me pretty hard.
How?
I run my own business,
okay.
and over the past, say, 5 to 6 years, I've seen fourfold increases in my health insurance, my professional liability insurance. My electricity costs have increased 5 times. I keep pretty detailed data on every
mm-hmm.
year how much expenses I have for tax purposes. But I don't mean to sound gloomy, but there's no way I can continue this. It's just almost getting impossible.
So what do you do? I mean, you got to make a living. You can't stop working.
Some of it is I raise my hourly rate, and sometimes that helps with my clients, and some of my clients can't do that. Other things is I've had to do other work. I teach at a local college. I've had to pick up other ways to make money. My wife had to get a different job,
yep.
which provided her health insurance. And I'm not, you know, to mirror what some of your other callers said, I'm not sure how the middle class can survive, even at a fraction of this inflation rate. And I know the earlier economist was talking about how energy and food is not included. That is most of my expenses, energy and food right now. I mean,
mm-hmm.
we live in the Northeast, and we're quite concerned about this winter how we're going to pay for the heating bills.
Yeah, a lot of people in the North from east to west feeling that. Thanks very much, Stuart, for calling. Ethan Harris, there's the voice of folks from Toronto to the south to the northeast. What do you hear?
Well, I have no doubt that there's a lot of pain out there. I mean, we're looking at not just rising prices, but a very weak economy. The two are kind of the stagflationary environment is something that is quite painful. And we've seen this before. We saw it in the early 1990s, and we saw it a decade before that. What I can say is that you know, over time, as the economy licks its wounds and we kind of get past the housing problems, which, by the way, are still quite serious,
mm-hmm.
We will see a better economy. We will see some easing back of inflation. Things won't feel quite as bad by next year. But you know, I guess I feel their pain. I think this is a very tough economy right now.
I'm reading here in the Wall Street Journal today. This is Brian Westbury, chief economist, another one in your chief economist jet set there, Ethan, at the First Trust Advisors. He's saying, you know, the Fed has got a money supply that's too big for these circumstances. The country's in denial, and it just may not come down just because oil comes down. He says, clear and present danger, inflation.
Yeah, I wouldn't say I'm in the jet set, but I never had an economist described that way.
Okay.
I think that I disagree with Brian, and what I disagree with is that the Fed is right now really trying to put the economy on life support here. They've lowered interest rates dramatically, provided a lot of liquidity into the capital markets, but this isn't inflationary liquidity. This is liquidity designed to hold the financial system together, to kind of hold the economy together until we get through some of these problems in the banking system and in the housing market. So I don't think that this is inflationary policy by the Fed. Eventually, the Fed has to raise interest rates back to more normal levels as the banking system heals and as the housing market comes back on board. But right now, I think they're doing absolutely the right thing. They have to supply the liquidity to avoid an even worse economic outcome.
Zvi Bodhi, what about it? The idea that the Fed is pumping in liquidity because we're up against some pretty scary recessionary dynamics, but it's not inflationary, Ethan says.
Right. I completely agree with what Ethan said about that. But there's another aspect of this that deserves mentioning, which is we want people to consume less oil. So in a way, mm-hmm. what's happening to the price of oil is the silver lining in this very horrible, painful experience with inflation that we're having. Because the only way, I believe, that people are going to change their behavior with regard to, say, buying SUVs and driving their SUVs is if the price of gas stays high. And let me remind your listeners that, you know, Europe lives very well and is adapted to a price of petrol that's three times what it is in this country. In England, it's $12 a gallon.
Yeah, we know the green argument, and we've had that, and I hear it. But on the inflation front, I still don't understand, can you really have liquidity that's not inflationary? I mean, what Brian Westbury is arguing today is this is a kind of denial. The Fed doesn't have a choice. It has to prop up an economy that's in trouble. But don't fool yourself. It will come back and bite you with inflation, he says. Ethan Harris says, no, you can.
Yeah, well, this is the perennial problem of the trade-off between inflation and unemployment. This goes back to the Phillips curve in the 1950s. There was a conference of the Boston Federal Reserve Bank this summer on the relevance of the Phillips curve to today. Mm. Well, there's always going to be a trade-off between the level of economic activity and the level of inflation. The closer you get to full employment, the more you're going to have inflationary pressure. There's no way around that. So the two
but
have
Paul
to be balanced.
Volcker, at the end of the 70s, which were so bad, came in and just raised those interest rates. I remember paying 17.5% interest rate on a mortgage.
That is correct. Yeah, and that's a perfect example. The only way that to crush inflation, well, then we did have a buildup over a decade of inflation that kept spiraling upwards so that at the end of the 70s, inflation was in the double digits. You remember that. And that's why mortgage rates were so high. Mm. Volcker put the brakes on through tight monetary policy. Interest rates spiked, and inflation came down much more rapidly than the economic forecasters had predicted.
But nobody can do that now, Ethan Harris. I mean, if we even tried that, we could trip this whole thing right off the rails, the economy, couldn't we?
Well, certainly Volcker had to step on the brakes in the early 1980s. You had runaway inflation, 15% type numbers, and it had been building for not just 10 years but for 15 years. But I don't see why the Fed needs to kick the economy when it's down right now. The economy is already weakened on its own in the face of these credit and housing problems. The weak economy will cure the inflation problem without the Fed kind of piling on and trying to, and as I said, kicking the economy while it's down. What I disagree with Brian Westbury on is that easy monetary policy doesn't magically morph into inflation. It has to work through the capital markets, creating easy financial conditions, and that's what creates inflation. We have no sign of that right now.
Let's go to Sandy, calling from Boston. Hi, Sandy. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom. You know, first of all, I don't have a PhD in economics, but I don't think you need one to have predicted that we were going to have inflation with oil over $100 a barrel and heading up.
Drives a lot of prices all over. No kidding.
Yeah, I mean, and it pushed everything up. But my question to your guests is this. We've been told in order to keep up with inflation, we need to invest in the stock market.
Mm.
Anybody who followed that advice would find that their portfolio has had a disastrous plunge. So I'd like to know, how does that advice, really figure in terms of the reality of the stock market and what happens if you try to keep up by investing during an inflationary period?
Sandy, let's go straight to it. First, Zvi Bode, you've been advising otherwise for a long time now. We talked a couple, three years ago. You said, get into Treasury.
And unfortunately, Tom didn't follow my advice.
Okay, I'm out there being whacked with everybody else, but Sandy wants to know, what are you doing?
Well,
what about the stock market advice?
I have been transitioning my personal retirement funds out of the stock market and into Treasury inflation protected securities now
tips.
For years,
mm-hmm.
so-called TIPS. And for my investments outside of the retirement account, I've been loading up on I-bonds, which are another form of inflation-protected Treasury security. And I suggest to all your listeners that they consider putting some of their savings, long-term savings, into these kinds of securities.
But it seems about 5 minutes ago that as cautious and wise as that might have been, it looked laughably like they had laughably small returns. People were looking for, you know, hedge fund-style returns or at least something in the high single digits, and those were never like that. You know, it was hard to kind of go with that theme.
Well, that's right. But the high returns came with high risk, and that's the part of the equation that the people who are selling equities – left out. You know, it was in the small print.
Yeah.
We are obligated to tell you that these are... Yeah, exactly.
Ethan Harris in New York, what do you say to Sandy now? He put it in the stock market. He's taken a whack. A lot of others have. Inflation may not go at the rate we've seen in the last year or a few months, but you know what it's done to portfolios. How do you see inflation interacting with stock market prices in the years ahead, Ethan?
Well, I don't think there's any easy answer right now. I mean, there are risky returns in a lot of different asset classes. And certainly if you're close to retirement, putting some of your money into inflation-protected securities makes sense because you want a very low-risk or portfolio as you approach retirement. I think that in the long term, the stock market is a good investment. Obviously, you want to have a balanced portfolio. I don't think it's going to be a great return in the next year. We're going to face a pretty rocky economy going forward. So it's really a question of your time horizon. But the simple truth is there is no, good low-risk investment right now. We're just in a tough environment.
Is it possible that what we're really seeing with this is just a reduction of the U.S. standard of living, that, you know, beneath all the little ups and downs on the curve, that's what's going on here? That's where we end up. Inflation's a very straightforward way of doing that.
I think there's an element of that. I mean, we've been talking about how rising gasoline prices are in some ways a good thing and discouraging people from gas-guzzling type behavior. And so I think we're paying a little bit of a price for that. I don't think that this is going to be a continued shift in high cost of living. I think it's kind of a one-time thing where we just have to adjust to a higher energy cost environment. But I would agree with you. There's been some sacrifice here that is more of a permanent nature.
And what about the globalization of the economy? With more demand out there from China, from India, and lots of cash in their treasuries, could they push inflation past a point where in the past it might have settled down?
Well, right now, emerging market economies like China are creating a little bit of inflation pressure in the U.S. If you look at imported products from China, they've been rising in price after many years of falling prices. But they're going to face the same thing as the United States. As commodity markets cool off, which we think will continue, we will see the price of the products they sell slow down a little bit as well. So the hope is, and certainly it's not there yet. I mean, this is a forecast. The hope is, and we expect, that those price pressures from China will ease back as well.
And what do you think of how Ben Bernanke's doing so far, Ethan Harris? You've got your new book out, Ben Bernanke's Fed. How do you think he's doing in this fight with inflation? How does it compare to Volcker?
Well, I think it's too early to judge him versus Volcker. But one thing I do sympathize with the Fed is that you have to judge the Fed by the cards they're dealt. And, you know, Ben Bernanke inherited an extremely tough environment, rising commodity prices, a terrible thing for a central bank to face. There's really no simple answer there. The problems in the credit and housing market. So he inherited the toughest economic environment since Volcker back in 1979. So we know that Volcker was a big success in kind of beating inflation back. And, at this point you give Bernanke an incomplete, but I think he's doing the best with a tough situation.
Let's take a call from Battle Creek, Michigan. Gary in Battle Creek, you're on the air.
Yeah, how do they figure the cost of living inflation increase for Social Security people? Do they take out the price of food and gas, oil?
In other words, do they use core inflation, the sort of fancy one, or consumer price index? Zvi Bodhi, how about that? How does it calculate? A lot of people really, really depend on that.
Right. There is, first of all, they do include food and fuel prices for Social Security. They use CPIW, at least I believe they're still using that. The W standing for urban workers of a particular type, clerical and it's not the same as is used for tips. That's the CPIU, which is the broadest measure of consumer prices.
But I guess the gist of the question would be, you know,
it
for somebody who needs that Social Security payment to buy their groceries and put a little gas in the tank, is it going to keep up?
Yes.
Let me ask you this, V. When we talked a few years ago, you were looking at some structural problems in the U.S. economy, national debt and right on down the line. And as I recall, you were saying, you know what, it may not be the smartest thing to do, but we're going to end up using inflation to get out from under some of these problems, that it's almost baked in the cake. It's almost inevitable that the government will sort of lean on inflation to make some of these problems go away. Do you see that happening?
Yeah, there's always been a particular train of thought, mostly among liberal economists, that moderate inflation is actually a good thing because it lubricates, it makes it easier to have real wage adjustments in the labor market. You can't lower people's wages
when there's
but you could lower their real wages just by not compensating them for inflation. Now, how much inflation do you need for that to happen, you know, to make it, to lubricate the wheels of the labor market? I'd say about as much as we have now. 1 to 2% should do it.
But are there some structural problems that inflation, whatever its side effects, might help the country out of?
Oh, yeah.
Like?
Well, we've undergone a major structural shift out of manufacturing into the services.
How does inflation factor in there?
Well, what needs to happen is that wages in those older industries, the ones where you need people to exit, need to go down in real terms, and they need to go up in the other areas where labor needs to flow to.
So here's the oil in the system, the inflation.
Exactly.
But what about on the, as I recall, you were saying, we've got these great debts to other countries. If you've got a long bout of inflation, they become worthless. It's easier to pay
them off.
Well,
that's true and not true, because capital markets adjust rather rapidly to whatever the rate of inflation is. So the interest rate that the Treasury pays on its debt held by foreigners goes up to reflect inflation. If there were, you know, as you pointed out earlier, in the late 70s when inflation was running in the double digits, U.S. Treasury bonds were offering 16-17%. Mortgage rates were 17. So you can't fool debtors for very long and get them to accept lower real interest rates.
So, of course, you know, they always say when the bank, you know, when you owe the bank, what, in China's case, $1 trillion, or I don't know how much we owe them now,
right,
you kind of own them. Let's go to Moline, Illinois, and David. David, you're on the air.
Hi. I'd like to say that runaway inflation isn't so bad as long as my wages are keeping up with them. But the current condition where my wages are flat and the cost of everything's going up, I'm getting squeezed right out.
How much longer can you deal with that, David? Do you see places you can just cut some fat here and there and manage, or is it getting down to bone?
Well, I don't have any place else to cut. My cars are $50 beaters, what I would call that. The only person that'd want to buy them is a scrapyard. My life has been squeezed as tight as it can get, and there's nowhere else that I can see.
Ouch. Ethan Harris, what do you say to David? Relief is on the way, or this is the new American economy?
Well, I think relief is on the way, but not quickly. I mean, I think that people are getting squeezed. There's no question about it. When you've got 5.5% inflation and wages growing only 3%, that means there's some people out there feeling the pain. I think it's going to take a while before we see a better economy. Hopefully by the second half of next year, we'll start to see better growth. We'll start to see inflation down significantly. and the economic climate will improve. But, you know, as I said at the outset, you know, it's kind of darkest before the dawn. I mean, we're in a, you know, it's a real tough economy out there right now.
David, good luck in Moline. I hope those $50 beaters get you around a little bit more, Zvi.
But there are things, although it's very tough to control your wages, I mean, or your income, you do have more control in general over your spending. And I expect to see a lot of people, and this is already happening, switching out of gas-guzzling cars into more economical cars.
But that doesn't happen for free.
No, of course. Well, I personally am now commuting to work on my bicycle. And I'm seeing life from a different perspective. For example, I had nowhere to park today outside of the studio. Now, that's going to cause me to complain to the BU administration.
Get a bike rack out there at every workplace.
Exactly. Instead of putting a sign out there that says, don't lock your bike against the railing, which is there right now, there's going to be a bike rack.
Yeah, but whether or not David in Moline, Illinois, or millions of others like him have a job they can bike to or need to find another job, that labor mobility doesn't necessarily happen on the back of a bike very easily.
It's painful.
So, yeah, let's go to Leesburg, Virginia, and Mike. Mike, you're on the air.
Hello, I have a quick question. Mortgage rates, the experts would make you think that they are going to rise. Are there any contrarians to that theory on your panel?
Let's hear. Ethan Harris, mortgage rates, where do you see them going?
Well, right now mortgage rates are very high relative to the cost of funds to banks. And the reason is that the banks are dealing with all their losses and trying to clean up their own financial problems.
So, what's a 30-year rate now? 6-something?
Well, it depends on the kind of borrower, but, you know, 7% or
7
so.
7 even? Okay.
You know, I think that as we get through this credit crisis as inflation comes down, I think that in the next year or two we will see somewhat lower mortgage rates. But, you know, there's a ways to go here. I mean, banks are licking their wounds from previous, low-quality loans. And so the risk premium or that the extra amount they're charging on these loans to cover risks is very high right now. That will improve. I think we will see lower mortgage rates, but, it'll take a while.
Let's go to Tony in Columbia, South Carolina. Tony, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for taking my call.
Yes, sir.
Real quickly, I'm not an economist, but rather a physicist, and I do algorithmic stock trading, and we're making a killing selling stocks short at this point. But what I really wanted to talk
about... Let's talk after the show, Tony. I need some advice badly.
But when I was a kid, we went through the 70s. I had 2 siblings in med school and 2 in college. So even though my parents were professionals, we grew our own garden, got our own meat by going hunting and going fishing. And even though I trade stocks and quite literally made 18% last month alone, I have my own garden. I put up my own pickles. I put up my own jam. I've got apple trees, pear trees, and I intend to go hunting this weekend to get myself some venison.
Wow.
So I think innovation and thinking differently may solve our inflation problem, and I'd love to hear comments on innovation in terms of energy.
I love it. We're in a new era. Svi Bodhi, the physicist, is doing his algorithmic calculations and then going hunting to put some meat on the table. Is that the innovation path we're on here?
Yeah. Well, first of all, good luck to the caller. I have many relatives who did great selling short and working up algorithms for the stock market. I cannot think of one of them who didn't lose it all in the end. But, you know, I say hope beats eternal in the human breast.
You packing a shotgun on your bicycle looking to bag a turkey on the way
home? There you go. Exactly. I think I'm totally supportive of the other part of the caller's statement, which is to the extent that you can economize on your own spending, find substitutes, in some cases healthier substitutes, then by all means, that's what has to happen. That's the function of the price system.
So tightening the belt isn't always all bad. but it doesn't feel good along the way.
It never feels good.
Well, it's been a great conversation. I'm very grateful to both of you. Zvi Bodhi, author of Worry-Free Investing, with me in the studio. Thanks so much for being here, Zvi.
My pleasure.
And Ethan Harris, chief U.S. economist at Lehman Brothers in New York, author of Ben Bernanke's Fed. Mr. Harris, thank you very much for being with us today.
My pleasure.
On Point is produced by Julie Jopp, Ping Huang, Eileen Amata, Stefano Katsonis, Hillary McQuilkin, Tanya Rowley, James Ross, Karen Schiffman, and John Wibby. Our senior producer is Wen Stevenson. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.